You're listening to the Riverfront Church broadcast, a place to explore faith, history, ideas, and more.
We are looking at the Gospel of John. Greek for John. So if you know anybody named Johann, that's for John. Or, you know, there are other variations of it. Juan in Spanish. But this is the Gospel of John. And the Gospel of John is very different from the other Gospels. Has anyone ever read all of the Gospels? And can anyone identify with, like, wow, yeah, John does seem pretty different? Anybody when they were reading?
Got nothing.
So just to kind of brief overview, the Gospel of Mark is very short. And everything seems to be happening like it's an action movie. Like, you know, Jesus then spoke to the man and said, this day you will be healed. And then Jesus was thousands of miles, you know, across the land. Like, suddenly, the next sentence, Jesus has traveled hundreds of miles or is in the next town, which in Jesus' time would have taken a while. So everything's just action-packed. That being said, you know, that some people kind of felt like Gospel of Mark was like, well, you know, not much there. Well, actually, no, there is a lot there. It just comes in a very short, it's like Ernest Hemingway writing the gospel without all the depression, okay? So, you know, there's that. So that's one way to put it. I don't know if anyone's ever said that in total reverence. The other one, Emma looked at the Gospel of Luke, she can correct me because she's here, but Gospel of Luke really does a lot of things. In some ways, it's very similar to the Gospel of Matthew, but it kind of seems to emphasize the role of marginal people, marginal communities, especially the role of women. And Luke has these wonderful stories, really powerful stories. Luke seems concerned with what does the good news mean for people who aren't in power? And that seems to be a part that's emphasized in the Gospel of Luke. Luke's also writing a history. So that's going to be different from Mark. Mark is writing an action-packed narrative, and there's some deep stuff in there, but Luke is trying to write a history, right? Because it's really a two-part history. Volume 1 is Gospel of Luke. Volume 2 is the Book of Acts. So in some cool ways, Luke is looking at Jesus and his ministry, life, death, and resurrection, and then what that resurrection means for the church. So he's writing to somebody named Theophilus. Some scholars think, like, was this a real person? Was it symbolically someone representative of, because Theophilus means lover of God, God lover. So, you know, like, was Luke playing with that image? Either way, he's still writing a history. So he's very methodical. There's a lot that he's packing in there in the stories. Yeah.
Is that where you get Theo from?
Theo, yep. Yeah, that's right, God. Theos. So, And then you've got Gospel of Matthew, which we did last week. Gospel of Matthew is, like I said, written from a Jewish perspective to a Jewish perspective. And in some ways, it is similar to Luke in that there does seem to be an element where he's trying to write a history. But I would almost put it, he's trying to reconstruct a history of the Jewish people, of the children of Israel, all the way to the time of Jesus. So it's really a reconstruction of history. For Matthew, it's important for Jesus to have the Jewish identity, the continuity of Israel. It's not out with the old. It's God takes the old and does something new with it. But God doesn't just get rid of the old. Oh, whatever. That was then. This is now. For God, God is reconciling the old and the new. So the Gospel of Matthew is rich with parables. It's rich with a lot of tradition. It's rich with a lot of the laws and the prophets that's going to be referred to over and over again, the fulfillment of it in Jesus. Okay. So you've got Luke and Matthew that are similar in the sense that they seem like histories. Matthew, I would say, reconstructed history. Luke trying to tell history in the form of ancient times, right? So we've got to always honor that. And Mark seems like an action-packed narrative. Scholars tell us it's the earliest of the Gospels. So in some ways, it sometimes also just seems a collection, like, okay, Peter, tell me again. How did it go? You know, what was the story? What happened that day, right? So it seems like Ernest Hemingway trying to tell a story with as few words, again, without the depression, like Robert Jordan, For Whom the Bell Tolls. All right, anyway. So now jumping to Gospel of John. Now, Gospel of John, totally different, okay? It is not a history. How do we know that? Because John himself tells us that. It is not meant to be a history. It's not even so much meant to be a reconstruction of history, unless what you're talking about is history, all history. Not just a story of a people, but the story. Okay? So it's cosmic. It's on a cosmic level. For John, and a great way to tell this is, we sort of talked about this, I think, for Christmas or Advent at some point, but think about the birth narratives, right? And they all tell it in different ways. So that's a creative way to talk about it. Mark talks about Jesus' birth through his ministry, right? The opening of the Gospel of Mark is Jesus being baptized. That's his birth. And in some ways, that's very true to the church. So I've shared with you, for the Orthodox Church, your name, you know, you ever hear of, like, what's your baptized name? Like, you watch a movie or old books, they might say, all right, Edwin, what's your baptized name? Well, Edwin couldn't have been my baptized name because it's not really a biblical name. So they would have said, okay, Edwin, but what's your baptized name? Oh, it's John. Because John, right? So it was honoring the Bible. The Greek Orthodox, other Orthodox churches still hold on to this. Your birthday is celebrated not on the day you were born, but on the day you were baptized. Because that's second birth. That's your true birth. That's the birth that matters, right? So that's where you get your name and you get a new birth. So for Mark, he tells that through the ministry of Jesus. The birth of the ministry of Jesus is his baptism. Gospel of Matthew, that's where we get the Magi. They travel. And that's, we talked about this last time. That's what's so radical about the Gospel of Matthew. Everything seems to be, yeah, there's the law and the prophets and the tradition, but it seems to be a little subversive, right? Because suddenly there are women in the genealogy. You don't put women in the genealogy. What's Matthew doing? Oh, and there are also people with scandalous, controversial stories in the genealogy. What are you doing, Matthew? And that's where I would say he's actually continuing the tradition of Israel's recordings of history, where you don't hide the flaws. You don't hide what's different. You don't hide it. But that's where you get the Magi and the birth story that we're pretty familiar with. Although there's refugee status. There's a couple other things that are different. There's the Egypt, the escape to Egypt. So it's kind of like the Moses and Israel story, you know. So there are a lot of parallels there. And then you got the Gospel of Luke. Gospel of Luke's probably the most famous birth narrative. That's the one we most read, possibly because of Charlie Brown's Christmas. You know, that's the one that what's his name reads it? Whoever it is.
Linus.
Yeah, Linus. Is Linus the blanket guy? No.
Yeah.
Yes. So the blanket guy reads it, right? And he it's a really powerful moment in that short, if you've ever seen it. So Gospel of Luke tells this beautiful birth story, the angels and the shepherds. Think about it, the shepherds, right? The outsiders, the marginal people. So that's a way. Gospel of John. What's Gospel of John do? Well, let's open it. Because the Gospel of John goes in a totally different direction. So who wants to volunteer to read it? And tell us which translation you're using.
Yeah, I'm using God's Word translation. And just starting at John 1?
Yeah.
Okay. The Word becomes human. In the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was already with God in the beginning. Everything came into existence through him. Not one thing that exists was made without him. He was the source of life, and that life was the light of humanity. The light shines in the dark, and the dark has never extinguished it. God sent a man named John to be his messenger. John came to declare the truth about the light so that everyone would become believers through his message. John was not the light, but he came to declare the truth about the light. The real light, which shines on everyone, was coming into the world.
Okay, you can stop there. Somebody else pick it up. Verse 10.
He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God.
Verse 14, Elaine.
So the Word became human and made his home among us. He was full of unfailing love and faithfulness. And we have seen his glory and the glory of the Father's one and only Son. John testified about him when he shouted to the crowds, "This is the one I was talking about when I said, 'Someone is coming after me who is far greater than I am, for he existed long before me.' From his abundance, we have all received one gracious blessing after another. For the law was given through Moses, but God's unfailing love and faithfulness came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but the unique one, who is himself God, is near to the Father's heart. He has revealed God to us."
Amen. Amen. So I liked that we heard different translations there. One of the well-known ones is, and I will just take a couple sentences. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. And the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth." So there the birth narrative is not shepherds. It's not angels. There aren't, you don't hear this encounter with Mary. You don't hear about the genealogy of Jesus. You don't hear about the escape to Egypt. All these different pieces to the life. And it's not, and possibly it could be, as scholars think, Gospel of John is the latest, right? So Mark would have been out and about. In fact, pieces of Mark would have, and remember, these, before they're written, they're being shared orally, they're being told and retold, but pieces of the other Gospels are already circulating, probably by the time John writes his. So it could be that John says, you know what, I'm not going to rewrite those. Those are all great. Luke did a great job trying to tell the history. Matthew did a great job of reconstructing the history of Israel. And Mark did a great job of sort of just giving us the content, not wasting too much time with the style. He's like, but I am, with 20/20 hindsight, I'm going to look back and I'm going to realize actually the birth narrative is bigger than this moment. It goes to the beginning of the birth of all things. All things are created through him. There was not one thing that came into being without him. In the beginning was the Word, right? So that's one piece. That tells us already. Each one is going to tell us a little bit about themselves, who they are, what they're supposed to do, what they're called to do. And John is certainly presenting us with the idea of this is going to be a different gospel, okay? So one is there's a cosmic level. Here's the other clue we have. The word he uses, we've talked about this before, but the word he uses for word is, there actually is a word for word in Greek, okay? Yep. That word is the rhema, okay? The rhema word. And that would just mean like a word, okay? But the word he uses there is not just simply a word. The word there is logos, okay? Where we get the term logo or logic, okay? That's really important because logo, what's a logo? Now, we might think of it, well, it's an image. Well, that's what it later became. But logo, what it basically means is what's your brand, okay? It's a brand. So if it's Nike, okay, they haven't sponsored this Bible study tonight, but if it's Nike, right, that means everything Nike publishes, does, like, it's got to stand to the Nike brand. Now, some of you might associate Nike with high quality or expensive shoes or child laborers in China, wherever, however you associate it with, right, it affects the brand. The brand is, what is the core identity to the thing itself? And that, therefore, you can see it in everything. You can see the whole in the parts, right? So the Nike swoosh symbol, right? Okay, yeah, that's its logo, because what it represents is its core identity. Just do it, Nike, right? A similar thing to think about is logic, okay? Logic is a reasoning principle by which things are organized, right? They are, they, it's order, it's reason for being, right? So the your logos might be, like, let's say if Maddie is like, I love art and I love spirituality and I love, you know, fashion, you know, all these different things. Maddie's reason for being in the world is to share her art, her poetry, and her music, right? That's her reason for being. That's her logos, okay? So when John uses that, he's telling us, I'm not only talking on a cosmic level, I'm talking on a philosophical level about in the beginning was the reason for being, and the reason for being was with God, and the reason for being was God. Or the organizing principle to all existence was with God. And the organizing principle for all existence was God. Or, you see, you can keep substituting. Or the core identity ultimately is God, right? And there's a godness that can be sent out by the power of the Spirit, right? So we can get these characteristics where we're patient and gentle and kind and we're forbearing and we're humble and we're loving. All these things become godness in us, manifest, right? So this is telling us, like, wow, he's getting pretty philosophical. How do we also know that? Because the Greeks are famous for their philosophy, right? You don't get through high school and college without at some point hearing about Aristotle and Plato and, you know, thousands of others, Aristophanes and da-da-da-da-da-da, right? Zeno's paradox. And, I mean, pretty much even to this day, any philosopher has not only read Greek philosophy, they still have to footnote Greek philosophy. Because there's some Greek philosopher that has spoken about atomic particles. And there's some Greek philosopher that has talked about, something like postmodernism. And there's some Greek philosopher, right? There's a Greek philosopher for everything. Okay, so there, you always have to footnote them. And so the fact that John is using that word, every Greek person that was educated would have known exactly what he's referring to, because the other philosophers referred to it. They were all trying to find the logos, the reason for being. So for Plato and any philosophers tuning in or at this table, you can feel free to correct me and send me very strongly worded emails and Facebook comments. But Plato basically thought, okay, there are these great ideals out there, right? These great truths. And the world is just the shadows. They're just shadows of those real things. So for him, the logos were these ideals that we sort of needed to imitate until we finally became free of the shadow world and could become these pure ideas, okay? So for Aristotle, by contrast, Aristotle thought, no, a thing is excellent. So if for Plato, excellence was trying to become as close as you can to the ideal, and then you have to wait till after you're dead, because that's when you're really free to become this ideal. Love, purity, humbleness, whatever it is, humility. For Aristotle, no, you are designed in a certain way, and when you perform according to your design, you're excellent. So Aristotle, the famous example is the table. So, you know, a table, what makes a table great? You know, the joke would be that Plato would say somewhere out there in the universe is this ideal table. It's the perfect table. It's the greatest table. And these are only shadows of that table. And if only we could one day build like that table. But it's not for us yet. We have to die and be freed of our decaying bodies and earth in order to achieve that. For Aristotle, this table was already great in that it functioned just as a table should. You can sit at this table. You can eat on this table. The table pretty much stands up to wait. It's pretty symmetrical. It's a perfect table. There's nothing else you could do to this table to make it more perfect. Why? Because it's doing exactly what a table should be doing. So for Plato, there's tableness, the idea of table. And for Aristotle, there's only table in action. There's the table as we see it and experience it, right? So Aristotle thought the logos is to find the design behind something and perform accordingly. So he has this idea of, If you're a shipbuilder, be the best shipbuilder, right? Find the design. Or if you're a politician or a philosopher, you should rule the city, because Aristotle was a philosopher. So, of course, philosophers should rule the city. They're best equipped to think on behalf of the population, right? Et cetera, et cetera. We could do this for all the philosophers. My only point is in saying they're all talking about the Logos. And they believed the Logos was something divine that also interacted with human beings. Philosophers could sort of discuss it and imagine it and challenge it and be challenged by it, right? And so here John is saying, yeah, you know what? The Logos, you're right on, Greek philosophers. There is a Logos, but that Logos, that idea, became, the ideal became real. So that's quite an innovative move. That's taking Plato and Aristotle and squashing them together. Okay, so this is actually, we sometimes underrate this. This is a philosophical move that John is making. The ideal, the thing we can never attain, according to Plato, here on this earth. And Aristotle, who's like, no, as long as we complete our design, we're good. John puts them both together and says the ideal has become real.
Even more so, though, just by those first few words, in the beginning, yeah. He's doing a throwback to Genesis.
Absolutely.
So he's mixing Hebrew theology with Greek philosophy
right
out of the gate.
Yep. So, and that's great, right? Because he is, in this way, you could almost say he is not only hearkening back to the book of Genesis, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He is also reconstructing that as a cosmology, right? So, you know, that might have been for some like a poem, but for John, this is like, no. This is not just a poem. It's the logic. It's the reason behind your life. It's why you're here. It's the reason behind all existence. And so in some ways, you could argue that John might say, I'm putting words in his mouth, but if you're a fish and you're out of water, you're at Bull Bay, and you're at this Bible study, you're going to die because you're doing something you weren't designed to be doing. Another example, if somebody once told me this, if you tried to make coffee with a toaster, or if you tried to toast bread in a coffee pot, it's not going to work out. Because as existentialist philosophers would say, these things experience alienation, right? Or if you were to fly out into space without an astronaut suit, your lungs would be crushed and you would experience alienation, right? You're alien to this world, okay? So in a similar way, John's going to say, if you don't connect to the reason for being, you're going to be alienated. And philosophers and theologians like Paul Tillich wrote that's what sin is. Sin is alienation. Sin is this anxiety that we get because we're separated from our reason for being. So our lives are disordered. They're in chaos because we're not centered on God. And so John wants to center us by saying in the beginning was the Logos, the reason for being. Get connected to this, okay? He's also an evangelist. Precisely because what he's doing is he's taking Hebrew theology and he's taking Greek philosophy, and he's going to later tell us. If you've got your John open, why don't you jump to the last chapter?
This is the disciple. Thank you. Was an eyewitness to these things and wrote them down. We know that what he says is true. Jesus also did many other things. If every one of them were written down, I suppose the world wouldn't have enough room for the books that would be written.
So,
mic drop.
With that, yep. Boo! Right. With that, again, he's another one this is another marking of what makes the Gospel of John unique. He is not just trying to say, oh, by the way, here is the account. It is an account of the life of Jesus, but he's also going, by the way, I couldn't fit everything Jesus did. So they're already telling him. I mean, this kind of makes me, gives me goosebumps. What we have about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus is limited, right? So it's limited. We don't have the full expression of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus in the Gospels. Okay? That's really powerful. Because, on the one hand, I think it takes incredible trust for God to say, I'm going to give you a picture. And I want you to follow this picture. I want you to study this picture. I want you to see the beauty in this picture. I want you to be inspired by this picture. I want you to see this picture in other parts of your life. And trust that in some ways the gospel is going to be alive in us. Right? So there's a point in which in the Gospel of John, Jesus says, greater signs than these you will do to the disciples. And I think he's also speaking to us today. We think of these as once in a galaxy far, far away, right? In a land far, long ago that's no longer accessible. But in some ways, you could read it and say, no, no, no. These are just some of the signs that Jesus did. But by the way, do you know that greater signs the Spirit will do within you and through you and for you even after this, right? That's really powerful to me, that in a sense, our lives, our experiences, our stories continue to tell the gospel story. So the gospels aren't closed. They are closed. The Orthodox tradition tells us they're closed in the sense that we're not going to write a book together and add it to the Bible. But it is open in the sense that each one of our lives are gospel stories if we let them be, right? They're gospel stories in which God is at work, okay? And we can see the signs and the wonders, the other things that Jesus has done that John can't even tell us all about, right? So that's interesting. John ends it that way. The other thing that's really powerful is that John is going to use seven signs in the Gospel of John. So he calls them signs. Now, what's interesting is Jesus himself, remember we were reading in the Gospel of Matthew, talking about Jonah. It's like, oh, this generation will get the sign of Jonah. 3 days, the Son of Man will be in the belly of the earth, like Jonah was in the large fish or the sea monster. So that's interesting, right? Jesus is talking about in a metaphorical way the sign of Jonah. John is going to use these seven signs to tell us about the life of Jesus. And we're not going to even have time to review those seven signs. You could do a sermon series on just the signs. You could do seven sermons on the signs. But the one of the ones I want to highlight is because, number one, John's telling us I can't write it all down. Number two, John's spending a good amount of time setting us up with a cosmological, philosophical, hearkening back to Hebrew theology, birth narrative. John is also going to put down the longest goodbye speech ever, which is Jesus' goodbye speech to his disciples. It's they're going to have supper together, and they're going to do this together, and they're going to do that together, and then Jesus is going to pray for them. And it's beautiful. It's moving. I don't mean to be disrespectful. I'm just saying it's very long. So think about how much room that all takes. And then John's going to have all these stories that don't appear in the other Gospels. So John seemed to have looked at the other Gospels or at least heard about them and said, you know what? They're missing something. They're missing this really powerful story. One of them is the story of the Samaritan woman. That's a really powerful story. Again, doesn't contradict the other Gospels. The other Gospel of Luke, talks about the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan. Gospel of Matthew talks about the Syrophoenician woman, the Canaanite woman. So it doesn't contradict it, right? It only seems to fit in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. The other story that John tells that don't appear in the other Gospels are the woman caught in adultery. That's one of my favorite stories about the stones. And everyone says, well, you know, the law of Moses commands us to stone her. What do you say? And Jesus writes in the sand, takes this dramatic pause. It's just a great scene. And Jesus says, he who is without sin cast the first stone. And one by one, everyone left. Because they're like, yeah, not free from sin, right? So it's a really powerful story, really, really moving. Those don't appear in the other Gospels, but they don't contradict the radical grace of Jesus.
Well, the other part about John is the really intense conversations that take place, whether it's the woman at the well, Nicodemus. You know, these aren't just quick back and forth,
like Gospel of Mark,
passing information or whatever. Yeah. This is fairly deep, philosophical material.
Yes, and that's right at John chapter 1. He sets us up for that. That's, you're going to see that throughout. So his conversation in the night with Nicodemus, that only occurs in the Gospel of John. His conversation with the Samaritan woman, all of these things, they go deep. They go really deep. And it challenges us to go deep as well. John is challenging our deeper faith.
Is this the John the fisherman? Was he a fisherman or was it?
So, you know, it's always hard to keep track of the disciples.
Right.
This could be John the fisherman, the beloved disciple. It seems to be, but who is exactly who? Not sure, but it seems, yes, as if this is John the fisherman.
Because it just seems like he goes really, just like you explained, he goes really deep. It's like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah. The challenge, perhaps, is that the Greek of the Gospel of John is a very sophisticated, advanced Greek by comparison to the other three. So either John was a fisherman and got really educated, or John dictated this and someone else who was highly sophisticated and educated wrote it down. But you still have the problem of the sophistication of the concepts themselves. So that's where it's hard. I mean, we get a sense of who the disciples are and what their backgrounds are, but we don't know totally. We don't know completely. But one of the ones I want to focus on, because this is a fun one, is the first miracle of Jesus.
On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, when the poor wine, but you are then the poor wine, but you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
So we have John telling us this is the first sign. We're not told this story in any of the other Gospels. It's considered Jesus' first miracle. It could be, again, what I started off explaining. Maybe the other Gospel writers thought, yeah, I heard that story, not a big deal. You know, we don't necessarily have to share it. Or I have limited time, resources, parchment. I'm going to write down the really, really crucial stories. John has the benefit of longer time to reflect, looking back, and being able to say, no, wait a minute. The wedding story is a miracle. It is a great sign of what's to come. Why would that be? Why do we think? So we just heard this story. There's a wedding. Jesus plays a crucial part in that wedding story. Why is that a big deal?
The bridegroom. That's the wedding when, because in Jesus' ministry, when he starts talking about, what was that, the one verse he says you celebrate when you're with the bridegroom. So it was a celebration. And that's his first miracle, showing us at a celebration and a wedding to celebrate that he's coming in to begin his whole Jesusness in this first time. So he's actually showing like he's becoming the bridegroom in that wedding.
It's a great point.
What else? Oh, I'm sorry. What if it's kind of like if you bring Jesus to your wedding or to your marriage, you are going to have the best wine all the time. You know, like being able to, it will be a successful wedding, mm-hmm. a successful marriage kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What else?
I think, too, maybe just that he wasn't going to do it. His mom asked him to do it, so he obliged. So you have Jesus being a person, not just a God. Then nobody really knowing about the miracle except for his disciples. So it's kind of like Jesus saying, I want you to know who I am and what I can do, but without, you know, standing up and being like, now water turn into, you know, wine in front of all the guests. It was really subtle, and, you know, nobody really knew. And it said when they served the wine, they knew where the wine came from, but nobody else did. So kind of just like a humble way of saying, this is who I am. This is what I've come to do, so you can relate me to God, but I'm not going to come out and say, I am God in the flesh.
Got a couple more there. This is crazy. So he launches into his actual service by being of service to his mother and to everybody else. He becomes a servant. And also the blood, him pouring out blood for the salvation would also be something that would be significant. Because he is the blood that cleanses the world.
Come on.
So there it is.
That's it for our statement?
That's it right now. That's all I gave
you
right now.
So I would say everyone shared some good thoughts. And I'm going to say yes and. And I'm going to respond by reading from another gospel. This is the gospel of Matthew, I believe. Yes. It's also found in the gospel of Luke. Jesus says this. He's being accused of basically not belonging to God. His ministry is not of God. He's an outsider. They're trying to push him out, being marginalized. So Jesus says, for John, and he's talking about the Baptist, and actually, when the Gospel of John mentions John, he's also talking about John the Baptist, right? Except at the end, right? But he's, you know, John the Baptist plays a big role. Jesus says, for John the Baptist came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. The Son of Man, Jesus, a title for Jesus, came eating and drinking. And they say, look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds. The next thing that appears in the story is a warning to unrepentant cities. So people who don't repent, basically Ninevehs, except that they're Jewish Ninevehs, not foreign Ninevehs, right? Why is that powerful? So on top of everything you say, so there's deep. So remember, John's only doing seven signs, and I'm about to tell you what those seven signs are. But I want to focus just for a long while on the first sign, because I think it tells us so much about all the other signs per all the points you just shared. Absolutely, wine is going to be super symbolic to an early church community that's reading these stories and going, oh my gosh, he turned water into wine. Right? It says that when the spear pierced him at his side, there came out blood and water. Okay? So he was pierced at his side, blood and water. So there's a symbolism. Jesus, John is going to take a long time with the Passover meal. Okay? They're going to be a while together. That's a big chunk of the Gospel of John. In fact, in some ways, you could say the Gospel of John, by comparison to all the other ones, even though he's philosophical and we'll get to some other style stuff, he's the one that most focuses on the passion, right? He focuses on the Last Supper all the way to his death. That's most of the Gospel of John, okay? So he's going for, that's the center for John. That's the biggest piece, the most important thing. And so taking the cup, this is the wine, my blood, right? Absolutely, that's going to be related. The fact that wedding, the idea of the wedding playing, the image of a wedding being a big role in the whole Bible, right? And we'll get to that in just a second. The idea that he is a servant, his first sign is that of a servant. He is, in a sense, he's the wine server at the wedding, right? A lowly role. In some senses, as Elaine said, you know, it's the humanity of Jesus. You know, he's at a party. You know, he's at a wedding. Everyone, so in those times, you didn't do invitations. The whole town came to the wedding. Okay, you just showed up. Okay, so you had to have enough for everybody. Okay, all those things are true. But the other thing that's true is it tells us something about Jesus. Jesus said, in other words, Jesus is saying, John the Baptist preached a gospel of repentance. And you said he has a demon. And he was basically an ascetic. I mean, he ate locusts and honey. He was like Elijah. He was out in the wilderness. He didn't eat or drink. And you said he has a demon. And now the Son of Man comes eating and drinking. And you say, oh, look, a glutton and a drunkard. I mean, that's a funny... Jesus is being really funny. Jesus is saying, it doesn't matter. You don't care about the messenger. You care about... You're offended by the message. And so you try to character assassinate the messenger. Because here's the... In other words, here's the Boy Scout, let's say, John the Baptist. And then here comes the wild partier, Jesus. And it doesn't matter. You don't like either of them because it's not them, it's their message. Okay? But here's the other cool thing. Here is what John has told us. This isn't just some dude with an interesting teaching and smart philosophy. He is the Word, the Logos, the logic, the reason for being, becoming flesh in your face at a party. How ordinary is that? Right? It's the ideal of becoming real. But then on top of that, he is Lord of the wine. What does that mean? The wine in those times represented joy. You always had wine for a celebration. Always. Because it was, let's celebrate. It was a symbol of celebration. What else would wine have been? It was a symbol of abundance. Right? You didn't have time in societies to make wine if you didn't have many resources. You just couldn't do it. Right? You didn't have the vineyards. You didn't have the time to process the fermentation. You didn't have the time to enjoy it. So wine plays a huge role all the way going back to Noah. Remember Alan talked about the oldest vineyard in the world?
Yep.
We think, well, according to the Bible, it's Noah's. And archaeologically, we've found the oldest vineyard in the world is an area where Noah was said to last be. It's kind of interesting. Alan had a little fun with that. But vineyards play a huge role because they signify abundance and joy. So here at the wedding, they've run out of wine. Okay, so they've run out of joy and abundance. Jesus comes to bring life and life abundantly. Right? Jesus comes to bring in what you are lacking. And Jesus does it with joy. That's what's so powerful. So we might, for those of us who grew up in the church or grew up around religion, I don't know about you, but I had a lot of boring experiences, right? Where you're falling asleep, and you're going, what is this about? I don't understand it. It is far from fun. Fun would never have been a word I use for worship, okay? And not just fun, joyful or celebratory. I remember taking communion. This is the joyful feast of the Lord. And I got like a crumb and I got a little cup and I had to like sort of dip it in the cup. And I was like, I've been to a feast. This is not a feast, right? So what they should have done is like Peter Pan. Pretend. We're going to imagine this as a feast. We're going to make believe. But, you know, partly because we could never match the true feast. But also because Jesus is Lord of the feast. Lord of the wine, right? So a way of saying this is the greatest party to end all parties is when heaven and earth fully embrace. Okay? And Jesus is signaling that. Right? Divinely turning water into wine. That God cares about our joy and our abundance. God doesn't want automatons and robots who are overly serious and take themselves seriously about life. God wants people who enjoy the life that God has made. And in fact, in the Westminster Catechism, no offense to anybody that's like, why are you bringing the Westminster Catechism into this? The principal aim of humanity is to enjoy God forever. Okay? It's to enjoy God forever. That's a part of it. So another part in the scripture I'm trying to remember, I don't want to say the wrong one, but might be Malachi. The prophet says that God delights in us. So have you ever just paused for a moment and thought that God delights in us? Most of my life, I've thought, oh my gosh, I've got to do this right thing, and I've got to say this right thing, and I've got to look this right way, and then I will finally please God. Well, according to the scripture, what if God is already pleased with you? Now, not pleased with all the times we mess up. I have not always been the best I could be. I've missed the mark. I've made errors. I've made mistakes, right? I've hurt people. I've been hurt by people. But that who we are, our identity, is already pleasing to God. God already delights in us. Think about the word delight. Number one, it's of the light, right? But another way is we thoroughly enjoy it. Think about a delightful meal you've had, delightful music you've heard, a delightful piece of art. You're like, oh my gosh, it's just beautiful. I get lost in it. A sunset, a sunrise, a friend, laughter, whatever it is. That's what God is experiencing for us. Delight. This is what I think John is getting at with the first sign. It's not only the blood that Jesus will spill, but it's why will he spill it? It's to rescue us from sin and death. It's to, you know the expression bored to death? There might be something to that. Jesus was here to rescue us from boredom. Think about boredom. What is boredom? It's just having a lack of a goal and a vision and purpose and a sense of, you know, the aliveness that the world is on fire around you, right? It's just sort of like, it's just another day, another dollar. I'm taking my breath for granted, you know, whatever. That's what boredom is. Jesus came to rescue you from that. Because that boredom truly is a sense of not being grateful and not seeing the beauty around you and not being helpful to your neighbor and not seriously seeing that you are, God delights in you. That's amazing. I mean, that's why I wanted to spend this much time on this. Because in some ways, to see this is to see all of John. The ideal becomes real. In what way? How does God meet us? At a wedding, at a party, to bring joy, to bring the party down. The greatest, that was probably the best wedding ever because of Jesus.
And let's face it, a wedding represents a new beginning. Something new created at a wedding, in that union.
Something new, a new union, but number two, it represents per the union relationship. Fast forward all the way to the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation ends with a wedding feast. It's called the Wedding Feast of the Lamb. Now, John will refer to Jesus over and over again as the Lamb of God, right? The Lamb that was slain for the sin of the world. There's the wedding feast of the Lamb, where, and what is it? It's the church and Christ. It's heaven and earth. It's our past and our future. It's, land and sea. It's all things reconciled one to the other at the greatest party there ever will be that has no end. So it's not, as I imagined it, a cloud with, like, you know, you're playing on the harp and you're singing hymns and you're like, oh my Lord, I hope I'm not tempted to betray God. This is pretty boring. No, it's not that at all. It's a party. And you have to see that through the lens. Okay, real quick, because we've got to wrap up. I'm gonna share with you the other signs. So other signs. So we have the water into wine. We have the healing of the royal official son. Once again, that would have been provocative. I preached last Sunday at Grace on the centurion, the idea that God helps someone who's basically enemy number one, you know, is a part of the oppressor, you know, it's a part of the system. You know, it's like, imagine that, you know, you're a people oppressed by the centurions, by the Roman army, and Jesus helps him. Right? Or in the case of the centurion at the cross, he comes to faith in some way. Again, this is kind of radical. Healing the paralytic at Bethesda. Again, that only occurs in the Gospel of John, at least in that particular way. Feeding of the 5,000, that's true of the other Gospels. Now, again, so here's another interesting feature. The feeding of the 5,000, that's John chapter 6. If you want to look, we can pause there briefly because we don't have that much time, but he's the only one that will enter into a dialogue about that. Gospel of John really goes into that. He talks about Jesus will talk about himself. as the bread of heaven, the bread that came down from heaven. He will refer to the manna that the children of Israel received in the wilderness. Okay? So, again, John's connecting, like Matthew, connecting to Israeli history. But unlike Matthew, he's going to really go deep and explain it philosophically. And he's going to say how Jesus will feed the world. This is a sign. So the feeding of the 5,000 is a sign of how Jesus feeds us. The Word, the living Word, the Logos, like how food is central to our bodies, bread is essential, so is Jesus, right? So that's a sign. But that's an interesting feature of the Gospel of John, monologues and dialogues, right? So Jesus will engage in several dialogues that are witty and interesting and deep and powerful, but then Jesus will also go on these monologues, okay? So that's a feature in the Gospel of John. Okay, we're on sign number five, Jesus walking on water. That is witnessed to in the other Gospels. Healing the blind man from birth. Gospel of John, Ken, you were telling me you love that one, right? Because that one is almost, again, it's almost philosophical. It's about progressive revelation. If you guys need a reminder of that story, actually, Ken, why don't you jump in? Let's get a different voice. Reminder of that story.
So, you have a guy blind since birth. Now, first, you have the disciples asking, why is he blind? You know, yeah. Who screwed up?
Who screwed up?
Was it his parents? Was it him? You know, what's the reason? And Jesus' response there, which we still struggle with today, because we still do that. We still live in a very simplistic cause and effect universe. If something bad is going on, it can't be for any other reason than somebody screwed up. Right. And the reality, you know, and in this case, Jesus says, "No, it's so I can be, God's glory can be revealed through this." So heals the man, and doesn't do it like right in front of him. It pretty much speaks a word the guy can now see. So he doesn't know who Jesus is. I mean, he can't identify Jesus in a lineup from that point.
Because he's blind.
But, when he can see, yeah. Jesus isn't actually standing right there in front of him. So, next thing you know, the religious authorities are kind of frustrated. I believe this is another Sabbath healing. And first they start questioning him. You know, Are you sure you're the one who was blind? It's like, yeah, I was blind. I was blind since birth. Well, who did this? By what authority? How? Why? The whole bit. And he gives some pretty straightforward answers at first, and then he, really starts harassing them. Giving it back as much as they're giving it to him. Then they bring his parents in, and it's like, tell us about, how this happened to your son. They're like, we don't know. We're just, it's like, we're a part of this. And then there is that philosophical discussion where they're saying, by what authority and, how can this guy heal on the Sabbath? And he's just like, look, he healed. Only God can heal. So I know where I'm putting my money. I know which side I'm on. And the more they try to entrap this guy who was born blind, which there might be something there about someone who's lived their life in that status of less than, that their powers of observation and of seeing, for lack of a better term, their BS detectors are pretty highly tuned. And so it's sort of like, what are you going to do to me? I can see now. You didn't do anything for me when I was blind, so, I don't owe you anything. And actually ridicules him at one point, like, you guys keep asking me about him. Are you interested in becoming one of his followers, But then at the end, he finally does get to actually meet and have a conversation with Jesus, and that's amazing as well. So it's just, but it is, there are elements there that are as good as any Abbott and Costello routine or Laurel and Hardy, it's.
I vote Abbott and Costello on that.
So, but again, there's some similarities there with Mark and the Messianic Secret. And Matthew, remember, the parables are only understood by those that whom Jesus chooses, which are like the simple, which it's like a backhanded compliment. You guys are special because you guys are simple. You guys are simple-minded, so you get the revelation of the parables. In a similar way, this blind man gets the revelation, right, the seeing of Jesus, experiences this healing in a way by contrast to those of great understanding and education who can't see it, right? So in that sense, there's a consistency there in the Gospels. That what God is doing is revealed to those that might surprise you, to those who like the blind man. The blind man isn't suddenly like, hallelujah! You know, the blind man's like, listen, this is what I've experienced, and I'm putting my butt, like Ken said, he's uncouth. He's not your most articulate, educated person. Yeah. He just knows that his life has been changed, and he's grateful. So in some ways, it's almost a contrast. If you don't understand what it's like to hit bottom, if you don't understand what it's like to not be in control, if you don't understand what it's like to suffer, then in some ways the gospel's so hard for you to get. Because it comes out of a community of suffering, and it's for a community of suffering. And I do think we all suffer, but are we all in touch with it?
You know, something else that comes out of that for me is that he's assumed to be born in sin, let's say, with this horrible sin that caused him to be born blind to the point that they blame the parents. Almost as if people that are born to think that they're just completely perfect and not of sin. And it kind of flips the whole thing. And I think that's the whole thing, because when you went into a canon, you were like, you know, they're questioning the parents, and the parents weren't there, but yet they were still answering for the son, who's a grown man, yeah. You know? And it's like, wait a minute, he had nothing to do with it. You didn't make him blind, and you didn't help him to see, so mm-hmm. why are you even being questioned about that? But that's almost the way that was looked at that time. But they didn't know about Jesus, you mm-hmm. know? And Jesus changed the whole thing. So I think that was kind of something else that was in there.
Right. The final things I'll say is this is the healing of the blind man. John is using the symbolism of seven, which we've talked about before. Could mean completion, could mean totality. Seven, for instance, the 7 years of abundance in the story of Joseph, that Egypt will have abundance, right? 7 years, yeah, maybe it was 7 years, but it could also just mean, no, these were just great years, right? And 7 years of famine means not maybe 7 years, okay, but 7 years of famine. So it heightens the whether it's good or bad, okay? But it's always going to also interact with the Sabbath and the idea of the creation story. Here is interesting, because on the sixth day, man and the beasts are created, right? Humanity and the beasts are created on the sixth day in creation. And here is a man whose eyes are restored so that not only can he behold creation, but as a man, he sort of kind of comes into himself, right? Because now he's able to be aware in another way. So there might be, now, John's not telling us this, but I'm saying these symbols are going to jump out at us. And we could probably look at all the different numbers, and probably, I'm sure, somebody's written about that. But the last one I want to focus on, because it's the last sign, and it's the last sign right before Jesus' death that John writes about, is the resurrection of Lazarus. Okay? Now, obviously, the resurrection of Lazarus is foreshadowing the resurrection of Jesus. Okay? The Gospels don't talk about this. But they do talk about Mary and Martha. So Mary and Martha are a big part of this. So pretty interesting. And Lazarus does occur in other places in Scripture. But here's what I find powerful. When I'm at a funeral or I'm at a wedding, the Gospel of John talks about both. It's the only one that talks about both. It's kind of powerful. Jesus was at a wedding and Jesus was at a funeral. Jesus was at a great party, and Jesus was at a place of great grief. But here's what's powerful. Elaine, you mentioned the ordinariness, right? The humanity of Jesus. He's at a party. His mom has to come over, and he's probably like, Mom, you know, what's going on? Leave me alone.
Mom.
Yeah, jeez, Mom. Okay. As reverently as we're saying that. But here at the funeral, there's something else that jumps out at me. Jesus, there's this great word, and I'm about to define it for you. So it's translated in different ways, but if you look at John, this is John chapter, is it, let me make sure I have the right one here. John chapter 11, verse 33, okay? Talks about Jesus seeing Mary weeping, seeing those around him weeping and distressed, and it uses this word, Clio, the Greek word clio, okay, or the root is clio. And it means, I'm going to read it to you, weeping aloud, expressing uncontainable, audible grief. Wow. Okay? Now, I sometimes don't really like the translation because it says he was deeply troubled in his spirit. Well, I don't know about you, but none of my friends ever say that. They never go, hey, how was your day? I don't know. I was deeply troubled in my spirit. Now, I'm not saying no one ever might say that. I'm just saying I've never heard anyone say that. But if you told me, if my friend was like, man, I was weeping like a small child, I get it. Right? Oh, man, I was like, or wailing, or I was grieving aloud, or I was, you know, what's the other word I used? It was audible grief, uncontainable grief. Okay? That's what it's what's used to describe Jesus in verse 33. To shed, I'm going to keep reading these. To shed tears, to lament, to sing a dirge, to wail, to howl, to groan, to bewail. You know, we can keep going, but that's really powerful. Can you picture Jesus, the Word? The logic, the reason for being taken on flesh, who knows what's going on and understands and all these things and can perform miracles, and he's the big man on campus. But he's weeping. Like, okay, here's another way to put this. Pretty much, women were famous for this.
Yeah.
At funerals, these ancient cultures, you see these traditions, the funeral dirge, they were often performed by women. Who dressed in a certain way, sang in a certain way, and wailed. This is true in Native American cultures. It's true in Middle Eastern cultures. So Jesus is wailing like a weeping woman. Okay? Think about that image that the church, or Gospel of John, and that the church has preserved. This image of Jesus. This is Jesus not stoic. This isn't Jesus like, just going to be strong for others. I'm going to hold back my tears. This isn't Jesus... you know, in control. This is Jesus with uncontainable grief. What's going on there? What do we make of that?
The Word became flesh.
Yeah.
It's like when he's on the cross. I mean, he's really feeling all of our sins. Like everybody's sin.
Shows his true humanity at that point. One of the first times, because I think that's the only time they were, other than when he was turning over the tables and everything in the market. But that's the one of the few times that he's actually showed emotion.
Oh, I disagree. I think it was covered in Mark and some of the other gospels. I mean, there's times where he expresses frustration. You know, can't you guys get this? You know, whatever. But
I mean, as far as like showing the physical like outpouring of, I'm not just pissed, but this is, blessed are those who weep, right? He's going through the Beatitudes at that point. You know, he's actually weeping and feeling sorrowful. There's one part in it right after that, and it says, but some of the Jews asked, couldn't this man who gave a blind man sight keep Lazarus from dying? And that's just such a powerful question. Like, he's sitting there crying, you know, wailing,
you know, howling, and they're just like over to the side, like, couldn't he stop this? You know, if it hurts so bad, couldn't he have stopped it? Which is one of those interesting questions.
And I think it's interesting too is that Jesus doesn't cry until he sees Lazarus lying there dead. Like, he heard about it. He's like, okay, I'm coming to see him. He knew it was going to happen because earlier in the text he talks about this disease will not end in death because this has to fulfill a prophecy. So he knows it has to happen. And yet when it does happen and he sees his friend lifeless, he weeps. He's human. You know, like Damon said, it's like the word became flesh. He really was just like us. If we saw our friend lying there dead, we'd cry. You just can't help it.
Yeah. And just to be accurate, it doesn't really fully change what we were just talking about, but the word actually, there are two words that are used for weeping here. One is for the women that are using the word that I just described, but the other word that is Jesus wept is, and let me just find that because I'm looking at this more closely. This is from the word, so that's for those our Greek scholars out there, dakruo, which is to weep, to shed tears. So Jesus is still visibly, publicly expressing great emotion by weeping, by shedding tears, okay? So this isn't the stoic Jesus we'd like to imagine. And with respect to our translators, I have to say that where it says he was deeply moved, it's actually, and hold on one second, where it says he was deeply moved in himself or in his spirit, it actually has a greater definition. So let me open that for a second. It's got, and again, this is just to show the humanity of Jesus that they're lifting up, right? That's so powerful. Let's go back to verse 33. Saw her weeping, and having come with her, the Jews were weeping. So that's the kleontas or kleo that was used before. He was deeply moved in spirit. That word is embryamoach. I'm going to try to remember my old Greek. Embryamachi. Ai. All right. Someone who knows Greek better than me, correct me, send it in a comment. But basically, something like that. Embryamai. Which means, it can mean several things. To express indignant displeasure, to be stern, to be moved with anger, to admonish sternly, to snort with the notion of coercion springing out of displeasure, anger, indignation, antagonism, a deep feeling that is moved to be stern. So this is fascinating. I've actually not looked closely at that word. So yes, it can mean deeply moved, but it's also Jesus is angry. Jesus is anger. It's almost like the process of grief. It's like you're angry, you're sad, you've got... So there's a full spectrum of emotion that Jesus is showing here. And of course, to Ken's point, there are other moments where Jesus is expressing this, but this is one of the ones that I just think really captures the humanity of Jesus. Jesus weeps with us and for us at the things that make us angry and frustrated and sad.
In this one version I looked at, in the Amplified version, it says, he was deeply moved in spirit to the point of anger at the sorrow caused by death.
Mm.
So I think that kind of says all of what you were just sharing with us.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Death, where is your sting?
Come on.
I also think that one thing is, growing up, going to church, but never having a relationship with Jesus, the more I study the gospel. This particular verse allows me to know that Jesus had personal relationships. He didn't just have disciples, but he had a friend. You know, that so it gives me permission to be a friend to Jesus, not just to have a closer relationship with him. You know, because he puts stock in that. Mm. That he's not just talking and preaching to people, but he's actually, he had to have created a one-on-one relationship with Lazarus because it moved him and to lose him. So that gives me permission to create that one-on-one relationship.
Yeah, yeah. So we're about to wrap up. So basically, I want to just in review, John is cosmological, John is philosophical, John is theological, John is theatrical, because there are monologues and there are dialogues, and he's making them work against each other, and within those monologues and dialogues is philosophy, theology, cosmology. And John is going to be focused on these seven signs. There's something symbolic about each signs. So down the road, maybe I'll do a sermon series on that. That'd be fun. But each one tells us something about who Jesus is. And I think when you put number one and seven together, the first one, the wedding party, Lord of the Wine, and the seventh one, the one who weeps with us, you really get the powerful, unique vision that Gospel of John has of God, which is a God that's not removed and distant from us, but a God who is with us at the party and when everyone has left the party, in the joy and in the sorrow. God's not just a fair weather friend or a sunshine soldier. God is with us in the good and in the bad. This will be in contrast to how we are with God. John will focus on the passion, and he'll really focus on how everyone will abandon Jesus. Will deny him, will betray him, will follow him at a distance, will leave him at his most critical hour. And there's this phrase that Jesus uses. He used it right at the wedding at Cana. Woman, this is not my hour. My hour is not coming. That phrasing means his death. So right at the beginning, right at the wedding, I think it is really powerful to think that Jesus is imagining himself as the bridegroom for the church. And there's a sorrow even in the joy he's providing, because he's realizing, you know what it's going to take for me to give you the wine, the cup of the new covenant? It's going to take my life. That's what's going to have to happen. And so in a sense, right at the beginning, the Gospel of John is telling us, with the beginning of the ministry of Jesus, Jesus is already knows what he's up against and how it ends. And there's just something dramatic about that, right? That's what I mean. It's theatrical. And that Jesus already is saying, woman, my hour has not come. In other words, the hour of my death. So that's a recurring phrasing in John. And then, of course, when he goes to Lazarus, I'm wondering if he's not only weeping with us because of the grief, and he's weeping in some ways almost like it was never supposed to be this way. It was never supposed to be about sin and death and sickness and all these frustrating things that happen in our world and the brokenness. It wasn't supposed to be this way, and he's weeping. But I wonder if he's almost also beginning to weep for himself, what he has to go through. He's going to have to go through this death. You know, so he's both moved in his spirit, he's angry, and he's deeply sad that he weeps with his visible tears. And then the rest of the Gospel of John is the passion. It's the Passover meal. It's the washing of the feet. It's the farewell discourse. Jesus says goodbye. He has one of these powerful moments where he prays for us, by the way. So Gospel of John is the one where Jesus says, I pray for the disciples, those you have given me. And not only them, but also those who come to believe because of them. So if we've come to believe, it's because of the witness of the disciples over 2,000 years. So Jesus prayed for us. That always touches me. It always gives me goosebumps. Jesus prayed for us in the Gospel of John. And then, of course, in the Gospel of John is, you know, focuses on the passion, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And that's the climax, right? And then it's then John has this interesting thing, and we'll end with that. John has this moment where, again, the humanity of Jesus, he meets Peter for breakfast on the shore. And Peter, he's fishing again, you know, so there's this whole, like, why are they fishing? Well, we can talk about that another time, but they're fishing again, and Peter thinks he sees Jesus, and he's like, oh my gosh, it's the Lord. So he swims over, goes to the beach, the seashore, and says nothing. And Jesus, it says, is just cooking fish. It's like, I don't know, it's like, Jesus has been, he's performed all these miracles, he is the Logos, the reason for being, become flesh. He has been crucified, dead, buried. Now he's been raised to new life, and then he makes breakfast. Lord of the Wine. He brings the party wherever he goes. Jesus is always eating, and isn't it always powerful? Isn't it so powerful that Jesus says, "Hey, by the way, when you remember me, when you eat and drink." I mean, almost no one else can say that. Jesus is the one who says, by the way, every time you're having a really good time over a meal, remember me. Every time you eat of this bread and you drink of this cup, remember me.
This is Jesus.
There's a way in which Jesus is present to us if we would only open our eyes. Right? And that's the power, I think, of that story. So here, Jesus, you'll see in the Gospel of John and in the other Gospels, there are all these powerful encounters between the disciples and Jesus over a meal. Over and over and over again. And there at breakfast with Peter, Peter is restored to new life after his guilt and his shame and his denial and how could I ever get back? He's restored. So there's something about this image of Jesus feeding us and restoring us and inviting us to a party. Something really powerful about that. So, I think I've kind of given you a big overview. There are a lot of specifics we could do in the Gospel of John, but that's pretty much all our time. So what are some takeaways?
The only thing I knew really about John, outside of all the other disciples and anything I knew, and this is why it's really good to fellowship, is John 3:16. But being able to sit here and discuss what that actually meant and what it means, like how specific this writing was and how it's not just, it's just like so like open ended, right? So it starts, the beginning starts the end kind of thing. And it's one thing you say, Pastor, it was like, it's the love story of God. And I think that this really puts that love story through the test. It's like love is, it's not, it's that eternal love. It's because it starts off with the romance, the wedding, right? And then through all that, and then all the little parables, like all of my favorite parables are in this. I thought they were in other ones, but I never knew that they were all contained within John. I'm like, wow, John was the guy.
Yeah.
And it seems like it was very thought-provoking writing. It wasn't just written to just say, hey, this is, okay, like there's a difference between a story and a message. You know, and some of the other ones were just telling a story. Like, here are the facts, A, B, C, A, B, C, D, E, whatever. This one is more like, okay, then this is why, you know, this is the true message. Like, and it even starts off with a question that answers itself but keeps asking you a question. And it's kind of weird. And as the stories go along, he's still going back and forth. And then there's like little breadcrumbs left in there of thought to say, this is not just a happening. This is not just something that you arrive at. This is something that keeps going on and on. So when you get to the end of it, you're essentially going to go back to the beginning of the wedding. And it's like, he says, you know, like, I could have wrote down all the specifics of what he did, but that's kind of like, if I were going to write my biography, like, nobody wants to hear, like, where I was born and all that other stuff. But it's like, what did I find my passion in?
during my life? Like, what was the thing that gave me, they talk about it now, like flow. Like, where did I find my true sense of being where everything, time, space, everything loses its all meaning and it comes to that point. And I think that's really what he was saying. You know, this is when Jesus was at his best. This is when he was really in his flow. This is the point where he was just like, this is what I was here for. This is my point. This is my, you know, my point was to save everyone and let everybody know, you know, whether you're at a party and you're out of wine or rather your best friend just died, I can still be there with you. There's no place that I can't be. And I know for me, I always thought that God was only in the church on Sunday. And this lets me know that he can be anywhere, anytime, and truly omnipotent and a friend. Like, I don't have to hide from him when I go to the club. I can be like, yo, this is, you know, this is a Jesus party. It's all right. So that's what I got from this. This really kind of sums up a lot of it. So that's it. That's
great.
I think what I got out of this and what I get out of this every week is I learned so much more. You know, when you start this, you're like, yeah, I've been to church, been to 100 Bible studies. I know what's in the Bible. But I never really knew how different all the different Gospels were. I used to think they were the same story told by four different people with just a couple sentences in between. But they're not. They're so different. And, you know, what I got is how you said, you know, in the beginning, you focused on the beginning of the book of John. That one special, you know, where he raises Lazarus from the dead, which really shows the humanity of Jesus and how he was, like Damon said, the Word truly became flesh in that moment. And then when you get to the end and you were saying, like, you know, Jesus was on the shore making breakfast. And I've heard this story before, but I never thought of it like that. Like, you know, here they're out fishing. They're like, hey, I think that's Jesus. And here he's got a charcoal pit. And he's like, yeah, sit down. Let's have some breakfast. And then I just read further into it. And, you know, he asked his disciples that were there. He's like, do you love me? And they all replied, yes. And every time they replied, yes, he said, feed my lambs, shepherd my people. Mm. You know, and he said to Peter, go and feed my sheep. If you love me, go and feed them. Go and do what I have done. Yeah. To, you know, allow this to continue on because you're going to get old and you're not going to be able to do this, so keep it going. And I'm like, wow, like, that was the whole point, was just to get them to understand and believe and then just continue to pass that message along. And it's so powerful when you sit and we get to share and we get to understand and we get to share what we think. It really just brings it to life. You know, I just have this image in my head of being on a boat and seeing a man sitting on the shore with his little charcoal pit and his robe and saying, hey, come have breakfast. You know, you get these images that if I would have just read it, I would have never got that. And yeah. It's, I think, that fellowship that kind of brings us together and helps us.
Yeah. Well, everybody, thank you so much for being here. It was good to be with you. Go enjoy the rest of this beautiful evening. And I hope that this look at all the different gospels has done, as Elaine said, enriched your understanding. Your faith, you don't see them as kind of the same thing, but they're really dynamic in how they interact with each other and even within each other. And I hope that in the season of Lent, right, we're looking at the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, that you would experience Jesus in a deeper way, in a new way, and be able to maybe see some things you haven't seen before. And I hope that's a blessing for you. And to our podcast listeners, we'll catch you next time. Alan is back next week, so spread the word. Alan will be back to using TV and video. But every Wednesday at 5:05 p.m., join us at Bull Bay 900 North Orange Street. 900 North Orange Street, Wilmington, Delaware. And Alan will continue to lead us in these next couple of weeks, and we'll hope to see you there. We provide some food. You can cover your drinks and be blessed.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Riverfront Church Broadcast. You can connect with us online at riverfrontwilmo.com or on Facebook. Just search for Riverfront Church in Wilmington, Delaware. May God meet you where you are and lead you where you are meant to go.